All right, Psalm 66. We spent our entire time last week on a topic that came out of a verse, verse 9. Let's go back and get a context here so we can move on. It says in verse 7, talking about a God. There we are, Frank, sorry. Verse 7, He ruleth by His power forever, His eyes behold the nations. Let not the rebellious exalt themselves, Selah. O bless our God, ye people, and make the voice of His praise to be heard, which holdeth our soul together, which holdeth our soul in life, and suffereth not our feet to be moved. Now, we spent the entire time on last week talking about holding the soul in life and how the Lord holds your breath and you wake up because He sustains you. And when you stop and think about it, there's no real reason you should wake up. Why don't you just go on off into continued unconsciousness? But it's the Lord's doing. So in verse 9, which holdeth our soul in life and suffereth not our feet to be moved. In verse 10, it goes on, For Thou, O God, hast proved us. Thou hast tried us as silver is tried, I also want to, I don't want to camp necessarily all night here, but it specifies, Thou hast tried us as silver is tried. Now, on one hand, you have God trying Israel. A lot of these passages are tribulation passages looking forward to the millennium. And so the Lord is trying the children of Israel prophetically. And it's going to move into the millennium where then their King, Jesus Christ, reigns over them forever. And as you know, the Great Tribulation will be indeed a great trial. But we take these passages and apply them to us, and they're still true as long as we're careful. It says, For Thou, O God, hast proved us. Thou hast tried us as silver is tried. So somebody's saved. I mean, the children of Israel were, quote-unquote, saved. If you're a born-again child of God, you're saved. And there's something that's true. First of all, just generally, Job says, man is born into trouble as the sparks fly upward. The fact of the matter is, whoever comes into this life gets trouble. A lot of it is because of sin, and we can track all that back and all those things. You guys know that kind of stuff, but lost people have trouble, and saved people have trouble. Some of that's the same trouble, because lost people die a physical death, and we have to face physical death ourselves unless the Lord comes and gets us out of here, right? But I'm trying to focus here. Notice, first of all, that somebody that's saved, their trials mean something that a lost person's trials do not. I'm not saying that you're not going to go through something of the same thing a lost guy does, but your trials mean something. Now, and you should think about that. A lost person. Go through all these tears and, you know, you lose your family and your kids go off and turn prodigal and you did the best you could and you work your life away and then somebody steals your, you know, pension at the end and some bitter, bitter stuff and, you know, what's it all for? In the end, you die and go to hell? Nothing. Nothing. You know, it's like, you know, it's just like animals, you know, except you have a soul. It's just like animals out in the woods killing each other. And a poor, you know, little fluffy bunny gets killed by a bobcat. Winds up bobcat poop. What's it mean? He was food. And, you know, you stop and think about it. You know, here we are. We were made in the likeness of God. A fallen image now as sinners. Everybody's born into this life. And here you are and you go through these things in life that can mean something if you allow them to. If you allow those troubles to lead you to a place where you can know Jesus Christ, well, that's where life starts. But boy, life with just tears and problems and troubles, yeah, and riches and happiness and honeymoons and stuff like that, true. But it all ends in tears. It all ends in a grave somewhere. For a lot, it ended in war. For many, it ends in just you know, horrific suffering through life. A lot of folks inherit a lot more suffering than other folks. And if you're lost, doesn't mean a cotton picking thing. Now, if you're lost and then you get saved, now it means something different. Okay? Because the Lord then has taken you out of the miry clay and out of the bottomless pit and put your feet on a rock and put a song in your heart and a song in your mouth and established your goings. But if you ain't saved, what good is living and dying? I mean, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul? It doesn't mean anything. So I want to just take a little bit of time here, and you note here that, you know, thou hast tried us as silver is tried, he says. And we're going to apply that to saved people because that's who it's addressed to. It's addressed to saints. It's addressed to God's people. This is Israel in the Old Testament. We know that we can claim these promises because we are his people being born again, right? First of all, you'll note that in verse 10, thou hast tried us as silver is tried. Now, I notice there's only two metals that are tried in the Bible. You know, it never says that the Lord tries diamonds or that he tries, you know, rubies. No, he tries silver and gold. In this verse, it's silver. Well, silver is a type of redemption in the Bible. Silver is connected with redemption, and gold is connected with deity, with godhood. You say, what does that mean? It means that when you get saved, that your life means something different, and there's a different kind of attention turned to you by the Lord. Sometimes it can be the devil's persecutions. I'll grant you that. Sometimes it can be other things, but the Lord turns attention to silver and tries the silver because that silver is a type of redemption. And he's trying to make something of a man. Your salvation is supposed to mean something. And so, and part of it is that what you go through in life is supposed to be different and of more value coming through it than for somebody who's lost and just goes through it and dies and goes to hell anyway. It's supposed to make you better. It's supposed to build your character. It's supposed to make you more godly. So the two metals that are tried are silver, a type of redemption, and gold, which is a type of deity. Now, I don't think that any of us are deity, but we have a relationship with deity that lost people don't have. And so trials. Now, folks, we all go through trials, and everybody cries tears. And, you know, you go through things, and you don't, let's face it, nobody wants to go through things. Abraham didn't want to go through what he went through. Israel didn't want to go through what she went through. David didn't want to go through what he went through. Nobody wants to go through what we're called to go through sometimes. But it's interesting that trials and being tried occurs seven times in the New Testament. Now, that doesn't all break down real clean into separate things, but let me take you to a couple of places and just see if we can learn something here. Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Sometimes we forget with all of the theological nonsense that's taught these days that this life is a veil of tears, and that the best of men go through things, and whether they're lost or saved. And the Lord has a particular mission, a particular goal in mind for his people whom he asked to go through certain things. And, you know, just a hospital stay for a Christian means something different than a hospital stay for a lost person. The lost person may, you know, exhibit all kinds of grace going through a hospital stay and then gets out and gets well, lives 30 years and dies and goes to hell. But a hospital stay for a saved person is supposed to bring forth praise unto God. It's supposed to result in somebody having more faith in God and more trust in God. And maybe it's all about being humbled a little bit. Maybe it's all about recognizing that, yeah, all it takes is one germ or one blood clot, and I could be, you know, I'm finished unless the Lord blesses me. But it's supposed to mean something different for somebody that's saved and somebody that's lost. Now, For instance, in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, this is one of the few mentions of trials in the New Testament. There's more mentions in the Old, and a lot of those apply to us. I'm not trying to restrict. I'm just saying that in chapter 8, verse 1, "Moreover, brethren," now this is the Corinthian church, "we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of afflictions," or a great trial of affliction, singular, "the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded under the riches of their liberality." That in a great trial of afflictions, so it wasn't a little trial of afflictions. And it wasn't the affliction of just one man, but these are provincial, regional groups of people. These are churches, and more than one are going through things. But how in a great trial of afflictions. So these are afflictions. These aren't just trials of faith. These are trials of afflictions where you have to really go through genuine hardship. And I'm just going to say it, and you know, then I won't be saying much about it anymore. But we are a little light on afflictions in America. And we just are. We just are. We've had it really good. When was the last war that was fought on this ground? You know, nobody in general, you know, if you live in a bad part of town, I get it, you know, that sort of thing. If you put yourself in danger, look, I always laugh at professional athletes that always get in trouble outside of strip clubs. Hey, stupid, quit going to the strip club. You're always getting shot or stabbed outside a bar. Don't go. I haven't ever been shot or stabbed outside a bar. Why? Because I don't go. Right? I mean, there's dumb and then they're stupid. But, okay, all aside. But this is a great trial of affliction. This is not somebody just doing something stupid. This is hardship that comes to somebody on a broader scale. It could be a war zone. It could be a deep, you know, famine, pestilence, that sort of thing. And, you know, in spite of what they've tried to build, you know, I'm aware that there are those of us that have suffered losses in this. And we're doing a funeral for a guy, you know, on Saturday. I know folks have suffered losses, but let's just face the facts. COVID has not been a pestilence where, I mean, you know, if you got it, boy, you had 50% chance of surviving, that's it. No, if you've gotten it, you've had 99%+ chance of surviving. And some don't, and some haven't. I get it. I know. But I'm just saying that's not quite the trial of affliction these folks have suffered here in chapter 8, verse 2. But how that in a great trial of affliction, what did it result in? The abundance of their joy. That's what I mean. Lost people don't go through true hardship and come out more joyous. But I've known folks that have gone to the hospital and lost a kidney or an arm or a leg or gone through something and have lost, you know, they are disabled coming out in a way they weren't disabled going in. And they have more joy coming out than they had when they went in. Now, folks, that's the Lord. And that's somebody that's allowing themselves to be put on a potter's wheel and allow the Lord to do His will upon them, learn some lessons along the way, and some of those lessons are humility. If you go to the hospital and you're mostly disabled, you're going to have an humbling experience. I told folks, you know, that was the hardest thing I had to face, being in the hospital with the stroke. I don't need anybody to help me go to the bathroom. Well, yes, you do, pal. I don't need somebody showering me off. Well, yes, you do, pal. Right? And if you come through that with joy, you're a better man or woman than when you went in. If you come knowing that you're weak, and that you have limits that, you know, you didn't recognize before you went in, you're a better man for it. The Lord did that for you. Now, so these folks that have gone through this great trial of afflictions, I'm talking 2 Corinthians 8:2, Notice the abundance of their joy. Now, they're going through all these afflictions. It's a great trial of affliction. How does that result in an abundance of joy? And out of their deep poverty, they abounded unto the riches of their liberality. That's something remarkable, right? And so sometimes, you know, we resent the Lord putting us in a valley and letting us go through it for a while. We resent it. But, you know, folks, that's really part of the Christian life. We're called to be purified as silver. We're called to be purified as gold. And everybody knows, how that works. You know, the finer's pot, and it boils off the dross, and the longer you boil it, and so on, the more comes off, and the purer the gold is. And so sometimes the more trouble you have, the more it's supposed to work on your inward parts. Now, let me just go on to something else here along these lines. Look, if you will, in Hebrews chapter 11, Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, and go down to verse 17. We're talking about, I'm looking at the Bible where the New Testament has seven different sets of trials. And again, they don't necessarily divide off into clean categories, but they each teach us something. Okay, 11:17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son. Well, did he really offer him? Turns out he didn't have to. The Lord provided for a lamb instead of Isaac, right? But Abraham was willing to do it. In fact, he had raised the knife and was prepared to drive it into his son's chest at the behest of the Lord. Why? Because he knew that God had made him promises through that son. And so he knew that if the promises that God gave him through that son were going to come to pass, that if he killed him, God would have to raise him up again. Now, folks, that's a remarkable amount of faith. That's what a remarkable process of thinking, where the Lord can take a natural man and change his thought processes so that the guy knows that God's going to do something. And like I said, Abraham was fully prepared to kill his son, which would have required then for God to have kept his promises for him to have raised Isaac from the dead. And in the end, the Lord says, stop, and had a ram for him, right? But Abraham was willing, and so God gave him credit for doing it. Verse 17, by faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, as good as offered him up. I mean, as far as his mentally speaking, he offered him. God saw he was willing. And he that received the promises offered up his only begotten son. You ever wonder why Abraham was called a friend of God? I was thinking about that a little bit today. I think that Abraham was the friend of God in a special respect, in that, he entered kind of into God, our Heavenly Father's position. Because Abraham said later, Jesus said later that Abraham saw my day and was glad. So on Moriah, what Abraham saw in effect was the fact that God was going to kill his son, Jesus Christ, for our sins. Right? And so he saw my day and was glad. I don't know that Abraham knew that he saw Christ's day. Some people have, Abraham having been preached the gospel on Moriah, and I don't read that that's the case, but he saw my day and was glad. Now, what did Abraham experience there? Well, Abraham experienced the fact that, he was willing to give his son out of necessity because God told him to. And he got brought into, in a way, the Lord's suffering, because he got to go through what God would go through when he's willing to offer his son. Now, surely, what Abraham did in being willing to kill Isaac, that doesn't quite flow with God, because God knew that when Jesus Christ died, that he would rise from the dead. He knew that, right? So what was, you know, it pained Abraham to be willing to drive the knife into his kid's chest. So what was the pain that God felt? Because he knew that Jesus Christ was going to get up, right? So what was the pain? Wasn't the pain for the Lord the fact that he was going to take his perfectly pure son and lay on him the iniquity of us all? That he was going to pollute his son? That his son was going to bear in his own body our sins on the cross? And that would have grieved the Lord's heart. It would have grieved the Lord that in that hour, in that moment when the sins of the world were placed on Jesus Christ, that God would have been angry at his son because of that sin that was on him. I mean, he bore the wrath of God too. Not just the holiness of God, not just the judgment of God in his own body, but he bore the wrath of God. My God, why hast thou forsaken me, right? And so I simply ask the question. Here's Abraham that goes through this trial. It's a tremendous personal trial. It cost him an awful lot. And it cost him, you know, I'm sure that Abraham was never quite the same because he was willing. He knew he had been willing, and God knew he had been willing. And so God brought him in and made him his friend forever. Abraham was my friend, the friend of God. But Abraham wouldn't have been the same because of his this is a personal suffering. It's personal loss. And Abraham went to his grave knowing that he loved God enough that he would have sacrificed his own son. Now, you know, he's calling that in verse 17 a trial. What you go through personally is supposed to draw you closer to God. It's supposed to make you feel a comradeship with him that you didn't have when you were going through anything, right? There are things that only are accomplished by trial, and you're looking at somebody that hasn't really suffered anything. I mean, my family is whole, right? My kids are even all in church. Some of them here tonight. So there's things that I haven't gone through, and some of you have gone through some things. I'm saying that the trials you go through and you start, you know, getting a little pouty about a valley that you have to go through that's a little dark, don't forget what the Lord is trying to do with it. And you're not being asked to kill your son. You're being asked to walk through a sorrowful time for a bit. And look what always happens. Those times always pass. For most all of us and all these things, you wake up one morning and you don't have to deal with it anymore, right? All right, I know that I'm stretching this out a little bit, but look in Hebrews 11. There's another trial here. Just take note. That second one, Abraham, is a personal trial. It's a trial of personal faith. Look in 11:36, where in the context of the Old Testament saints, it says, you know, they've been through all these things. Verse 33, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. I mean, some of these, you can, if you know the Bible, you know some of the Bible characters that might have fulfilled these things, but there's stuff in here that we don't read about in the Bible. Verse 35, women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had a trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover of bonds and imprisonment. Trial of cruel mockings. You know, what little reproach we as Bible believers, whatever names people want to call us, Bible freak, Jesus freak, Ruckmanite, what in fire does that matter in the end? You don't even feel the flames, right? It's just reproach. It's just people saying stupid stuff that, by the way, they're going to all be proved wrong in time, right? So what does it really matter? But it says in verse 36, others had a trial of cruel mockings and scourgings. You're aware, I hope, that, you know, if you're a little bit, you know, antsy and about being called names and bearing some of the reproach, and because nobody likes bearing reproach, and especially today when everything, we're all supposed to be able to get along with everybody, and a Christian's supposed to be nice and, you know, just get along to go along and get along and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's hard to sometimes stop and take a stand that you know is going to cause you to be laughed at and reproached. But you look at what these people did. They had a trial of cruel mockings and scourgings. Well, none of us have ever been scourged, right? Think about all of the Christians in history that were Bible believers that got called all kinds of nasty names. You know, Acts 11 is the place where it first talks about Christians. They were first called Christians at Antioch. Now, we read it, if you're not careful, you read it, and they were first called Christians at Antioch. I don't think it was said like that. They were first called Christians. Oh, Christians. Followers of Christ, Christians. That's how it was said, because I've heard it said with other words. Ruckmanite, or in the Bible, in church history, Montanists, Donatists, Novatians, Albigenses, Waldenses. All those were you know, names that were spoken as people spit them out. And, I mean, to be called that was the same in many of those cases as being proclaimed an enemy of the state, the Roman Empire. Because if you were part of an illicit religion in the Roman Empire, you were an enemy of the emperor. And so you were due capital punishment. And so here we are living in a largely perfectly free country, at least up to this point. And, you know, somebody calls us a nasty, skanky name, and it all but drives us under the chair. Who cares what they think? But it's a trial. Folks have to go through that trial. Everybody has to pass. If you're going to be part of a church where you're going to minister publicly and try to do something more for the Lord than the average, then you have to suffer those things. But make no bones, you're supposed to pass that trial. I mean, your Savior was hung on a cross after being flayed alive, hung on a cross with no clothes for the public to view, and He died a wretched death. And so, why should I care what names they call me? Right? Jesus freak. Oh, give me a baby aspirin, please. Why should it matter? Keep rolling here just a little bit. We're looking at these trials. It's plain that I'm going to take all night, so you'll be here till 12. You'll be fine. James 1. I really do intend to every time to come in here and get past one verse, but I'm sorry. The ideas develop and sometimes in my head, and so here we are. James chapter 1, verse 12. Very familiar verses to everybody. Notice verse 12. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation. For when he's tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord promised to them that love him. Let no man say when he's tempted, I'm tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. Now, most of us should bow our heads in shame. Now, I can say that I should bow mine. I mean, what real temptations have you overcome? Who here doesn't have a besetting sin that you wouldn't be ashamed to admit to in public? Right? I'm not talking about just, you know, really skanky stuff. I'm talking about, you know, the way you feel about somebody or the way you think when you wake up at 1 a.m. and lay there thinking. Right? I mean, who wouldn't be disgraced publicly to have to be exposed for all that crosses through your dirty, stinking mind, right? Or your bitter mind, or your resentful mind, or your self-pitying little wah-wah mind. right? Hello, I apparently hit some home there. But it says in verse 12 that blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he's tried, he shall receive the crown of life. You're supposed to endure trials. And this trial has to do not with personal faith or not being scourged and reproached, but it has to be, you know, it has to do with just, you know, being tempted. You know, when you're alone and everybody knows you'll behave yourself with people around. But how do you behave yourself when you're alone? Man, it cuts to the bone, cuts to the quick. I've known folks that have, you know, in these things and nothing wretched and abominable outwardly, nothing perverted, nothing pollutive physically. I've known folks to drive themselves into the grave with, you know, yielding to temptations that they should have grown out of. Like I said, self-pity, you know, resentfulness, bitterness, you know, somebody. And there are folks that you talk to and you realize that, you know, we're all big babies. And you should overcome those temptations. You think the Lord doesn't care that you wake up at night and think about some things that you think about. And hating still somebody that you hate, resenting still that thing that happened between you and him or her and her and she and whatever, you know, all those years ago. And there are people that still live 25 years ago in something that happened, and here we are 25 years later. You say, what's the point? The devil knows how to trip your switch. He knows where the chinks in the armor are, and he knows, you know, that certain things will trigger thoughts, and so, boy, the triggers are all around. But it says there in verse 12, blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he's tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord promised to them that love him. And the fact that I keep falling for this thing, this besetting sin, says something for my love for him. Because every time the devil shows up and says, hey, look at this, you go, yeah, like some chihuahua, you, like the donkey being led with the carrot. You know, you just get led along. It says something for your love for the Lord, your lack of it, my lack of it. So I'm just saying, you know, we're talking here about trials. The verse in Psalms says, for thou, O God, hast proved us, thou hast tried us as silver is tried. We are being tried as silver and gold, the finer and the furnace. The furnace is for gold, the fining pot is for silver. And the Lord's boiling off the silver and the gold because he's because you're saved and because you have Jesus Christ dwelling in your body, and you're supposed to be more godly at the end of the day than when you started. And sometimes we get bogged down, right? Look here at just a couple other things. I know that this has been intense tonight, but 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 7. All right, again, these are very common verses. We're kept by the power of God, verse 5, through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. Wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold, there it is, temptations, that the trial, there's the trial word, that the trial of your faith, now this is a trial of faith. It's not temptation so much, and it's not quite like Abraham's. It's not personal in that sense, but the trial of your faith. So there are doubts, and the devil compounds on those doubts and exploits them. That the trial of your faith, there's things that don't make sense to you. If God loved me, if the Bible's true, then why does this happen like this? Right? That the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. So you're told, you're all but promised there that your faith is going to come under trial. There's going to be things that the Bible says and they don't make sense to you the way they progress through life. Right? I mean, why would the Lord allow a baby to die? Baby never did anything wrong. Why do babies get cancer and die after 2 years, after all these treatments and putting mom and dad through, you know, hell on earth? Why would the Lord do that? Well, it might just be to try your faith. Right? Because the little baby dies and goes to heaven. But not all people that had little babies that died and went to heaven are going to heaven. And for a Christian going through seeing something like that happen where things don't make sense, you know, Lord is trying your faith. Will you trust me? Or it gets back to Abraham. Yes, I'm telling you to kill your son. Are you willing to kill your son? And Abraham didn't know until the moment before that the Lord was going to spare him from that, right? But the trial of your faith being much more precious. Precious to who? Well, precious to God, obviously, right? But if it's precious to God and you love him, why shouldn't it be precious to you? Say, because I don't like it. Yeah. And you're more concerned about you than him. It's deep water. And I just really don't like even preaching about it, to be honest with you. Look here in 4:12, 1 Peter 4:12. I'm going to quit in a second. I just want to get through all seven. 4:12. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you. And this is a fiery trial. This is rough stuff. And okay, think it not strange. The first thing you think of is that it's strange. You think it's strange that the Lord would allow you to go through something like this. After all, you're a Christian. And after all, you love God and he's supposed to love you. And Jesus died for me. And so I just don't see why I have to go through this. Right? It's a fiery trial. I mean, it's tough stuff. I've known some folks that go through hard things. Have you? Most of us have. Verse 12, he says, Beloved, think it not strange. There is no temptation taken you but such as is common to man, right? One of the things that is most common for every man that has to go through something is he wants to hold it against God that the Lord is allowing us this to happen the way it is. Right? And somehow you have to escape that temptation because the Lord maketh a way to escape it. But it says in verse 12, Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you. There is no temptation taking you but such as is common to man. There's nothing you go through that probably another huge number of people in this world are going through right now. It's just true. Okay, I got one more for you, and then we'll shut her down, okay? And then we'll cover more verses next time. Maybe. Revelation 2:10. Revelation 2. Revelation 2:10. Fear none of these things which thou shalt suffer. I know this is prophetically to somebody in the tribulation. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, I'll give thee a crown of life. Okay, faithful to death. Faithful to death. There's somebody tried, and they're faithful to death. But they're given a crown of life. That thing in James 1, somebody's also given a crown of life for what? Enduring temptation. It's profound to me that it means as much to God that I would endure temptation as if I would have died for him. Some folks wouldn't mind dying for him under if the conditions were right and if the cause was glorious enough, and maybe they could make their way into the history books and stuff like that. But boy, when it comes to enduring temptation when you're alone. But according to the scriptures, the Lord gives the same crown to somebody who loves him enough to endure temptation as somebody who loves him enough to die for him. That's a profound thing. It's a profound thing. All right. Any questions or comments? Cole.